Over NBC's coast-to-coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable continues its important series on problems of Asia with a report on Communist China, the fifth in a series of programs about Asia. To begin today's discussion of Communist China, we present Phillips Talbot, authority on Southeast Asia and a senior associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. Now, Mr. Talbot.
American soldiers are now fighting north of the 38th parallel in Korea. Last week, the communist Chinese leaders announced that they would not tolerate the defeat of the North Koreans. But what is this communist China that we now face? We have had a lot of argument in America about Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong, and the seating of communist China or nationalist China in the United Nations. But we know very little about communist China, what it is, the failures, the successes, and what is happening there. In an effort to seek out the important things about communist China today, there are taking part with me in today's University of Chicago Roundtable two Americans who have studied China intensively. Albert Ravenholt returned from China and Southeast Asia only 3 weeks ago. A foreign correspondent in the Far East during the war, he went back to China in 1948 as a correspondent of the Chicago Daily News and an associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. He visited large cities and small villages in central, west, and south China and covered the fall of Nanking and Shanghai to communist forces. Ravenholt, are the Chinese now copying the Russian Revolution?
Not exactly. The Russians came to power in a somewhat different fashion. About 200,000 more or less Bolsheviks in Russia seized control of the big cities, the lines of communication, and then set out to fight a civil war and to make a revolution. In China, the Chinese communists took the cities and the lines of communication last. Before they got there, they had already organized their revolution in the countryside of North China. That means, in effect, that by the time they established their dictatorship, they had achieved a broader base for that dictatorship than the Russians had when they came to power.
Also taking part in today's Chicago Roundtable is Professor Derek Bada of the University of Pennsylvania. Bada lived in China as a boy and returned in 1931 to study on a Harvard Yenching Institute fellowship until 1937. A student of Chinese language and philosophy, he went out once again in 1948 as a Fulbright scholar and lived in Peking first in the last days of Kuomintang rule and then for 7 months after the communists took control. His book, Peking Diary, a record of those experiences, is to be published in a few weeks. Bada, what kind of country are the communists trying to organize?
Well, there are several points to be kept in mind. First, the fact that there have been decades of war and no really unified country in recent times. Secondly, the fact that there has not been a long democratic tradition in China, as there has been in the West, but a tradition of rule by a ruling group, which in a way makes the task of a Chinese communist easier today. And thirdly, the fact that there have been strong family ties, which the communists are now trying to change into allegiance to a centralized state.
Is this a completed revolution, Ravenholt?
No, I think we have to make a very clear distinction in our own minds between the areas of China where the communists really apply the revolution and where they're just getting started. The revolution so far has been carried out in a fairly small area totaling about one-fourth of China, in the northern and central part of China, north of the Yangtze River. In that area, the Chinese communists have, to use their term, turned over the society.
Does this mean that they have done the agrarian reform of which we hear so much?
That's correct. That is, they've used land reform as a tool to eliminate the old social groups and the old political groups who control the society and to bring into being a new social order which is patterned along the lines that they intend to make over the rest of China.
One of the things, Ravenholt, which has often been charged to the Chinese communists, is that they are agrarian reformers and merely agrarian reformers. Is that correct?
I think the Chinese communists would be the first to disagree with you. That is, the Chinese communists see their job simply as using the tools that are available in the countryside to achieve a base for carrying through a total reorganization of the society.
And what they're doing at present is a means towards an end. The present stage of land reform they themselves recognize is only the first step, which will go on eventually to collectivization.
I think we have to keep in mind also that this revolution, in its essential terms, is only being carried out in a small area of China now. The large areas of South China, West China, and Northwest China are in effect today ruled by the Chinese communist armies who hold powers in those areas. So whereas you have considerable popularity for the new government in certain areas of North China where the revolution has been carried through, in South China, West China, Northwest China, you may have as much as 90% of the people violently opposing the new regime.
One of the problems that other revolutionary movements in other parts of Asia have faced is that they have a small core of people who are very enthusiastic about the revolution, but when they get governmental responsibility, they find they don't have nearly enough people to actually run the revolution.
Well, the biggest bottleneck in the communist revolution at the present time is their lack of enough political workers. To turn over the society, using their term, takes individual young Chinese men and women who will go out in the village and try to implement the new communist reforms, try to implement a new communist order. In some cases, they have had to scratch the bottom of the barrel and take in students and others and train them rapidly in a few weeks' time and send them south. In areas of South China, such as Jiangxi province, the farmers have killed some of these students who were coming out trying to tell them how good the new communist government was when these farmers didn't agree with them.
Bada, as a person concerned with Chinese philosophy, I wonder what your experience is in terms of the religious program and convictions of the communists.
The communists have a Marxist attitude towards religion. They say that religion is a part of the old feudalistic society, which eventually will be done away with, but they say by means of education, not by violence. In other words, they permit religious tolerance, religious freedom, but they themselves are also free to make propaganda against it. That is the present situation. As far as the Chinese people themselves are concerned, I think that question of religious freedom doesn't rank as large in their minds as it does in the minds of us Westerners. Religion has not been a dominant factor in their lives for quite a long while.
It's also my impression that the Chinese communists make distinctions between various kinds of religion. For example, they've classified the Mohammedans in Northwest China as a minority and give them special consideration.
In so doing, they followed the Kuomintang point of view.
That's true, yes. And also they classified various religious groups according to the extent to which the communists believe they might prove useful in the communist efforts to make over the country.
You gentlemen have spoken about agrarian change, about education, about religion. The thing that concerns me is some of the basic problems which any government of China must face. Problem of production, but particularly in this year, owing to the reports we have had, the problem of the famine in China and how that affects the communist position.
I think, in a sense, that's perhaps the overwhelming consideration in the minds of a great number of Chinese today and of the communist government as well. We had last winter a very severe famine, probably the worst since 1878. In 1878, 15 million people died. We don't know how many people died last winter, but the famine resulted essentially from a combination for the first time in this century of a large flood in the Yangtze River and a drought followed by a flood in the northern plains of China. The result of that was that there was extensive starvation. 32 million people starved, for example, in one area last winter. And it's been followed now this summer by another flood followed by drought in certain areas and the reverse in the central China plain. It means that we're going to have an even worse famine next winter than we had last winter.
How many people did you say starved in one area?
Last winter, last February, 32 million people were off the grain diet in northern Jiangsu, southern Shandong, and northern Anhui. That means that they had to live from February until this summer on roots, whatever they could scrape up.
Two things occur to me in respect to the famine. One is the political effect it may have. Can the Chinese communist regime survive what must be a major tragedy spreading over a very large part of the country?
The Chinese communists have made very energetic attempts to redistribute food throughout the country. That is, they've taken large amounts of food from Sichuan and brought it down to central China. In essence, the Chinese communists also have had to decide who was going to die. There was not enough food to go around, and they, in effect, have chosen to give first priority to the big cities, the army, the famine areas where there were literate groups, and other areas and communities within the country whom they considered valuable. That meant taking the food away from the peasants.
And letting them starve.
In effect, many of them had to starve, yes.
These taxes, I take it, must have been confiscatory.
Well, for many years in China, land taxes have been collected in kind. In Sichuan province last winter, the Chinese communists collected taxes on rice, which were heavier than those within the memory of any person living. And the result of that, of course, was that you generated a great deal of resentment and hatred among many of the farmers. And you have at the present time, or had last spring, perhaps 400,000 so-called guerrillas, including some bandits who were opposing the communists in Sichuan province. Sichuan has about 60 million people.
But do you think, Ravenhold, that that is a serious problem as far as that resistance is concerned in Sichuan?
I don't think it's a serious challenge to communist authority, because the communists, for example, were able to take troops out of Sichuan and send them to Manchuria in spite of the fact that they had 400,000 guerrillas
right.
In Sichuan.
In recent months, there have been suggestions by American mission groups and others that perhaps the United States might assist, not as a political measure, but in sending grain to China to keep people from starving.
I think the Chinese communists are perhaps would refuse to accept that aid. At least the Chinese communists are convinced today that if we give aid to China, it'll be given only to upset their government.
I may say that when I was there, they made open statements to the effect that they would not accept any aid if it came from the United States government.
That problem of the famine obviously is one of the serious problems facing the communist regime. I wonder if we can make a brief checklist of the failures and the successes that the communist regime has so far chalked up.
It's my impression, Delbert, that the first mistake the Chinese communists are making from a long-range point of view is the assumption on their part that they can copy Russia. The Russians came to power in an entirely different situation, that is, the Bolsheviks in Russia. They had large areas of undeveloped land, they had forest resources which had not been tapped, fisheries, etc. In China, there are no large potential natural resources that do not require heavy capital investment. Now, that means that in order to achieve increase in production, which is a fundamental problem in China, the communists must seek to be successful, a different emphasis in their revolution than the Russians had to seek in their own country.
But on the other hand, isn't it true that they have followed a pattern in the past in China which was quite different from that followed in Russia, as I think you yourself said?
That's correct.
They worked out their program on the basis of empirical experience according to their own local conditions.
But I have detected, especially within the last year, a tendency, particularly among the more doctrinaire Chinese communists, to shift over in trying to solve their problems of industrialization to applying Russian techniques which may or may not be suitable to China.
Yes, I think that's true, particularly on the field of foreign relations, which we have discussed
later. In the field of foreign relations, yes.
But in some countries of Asia, there is a feeling that if only you can get rid of the landlords, then all the agrarian problems will be solved. I don't know whether that feeling exists in China, but is it a valid expression in China?
No, I wouldn't say that it is. I think that among the higher-ups in the communist hierarchy, it is realized that the creation of a new social organization is only the first step towards solving their economic problems. However, among the lower Ganbu groups, the cadres, there is sometimes, I believe, the doctrinaire assumption that simply reform the society and automatically the economic situation will improve.
The professors and others I've talked to who've come out of China recently, and also from discussions with some communists, I get the distinct impression that the Chinese communists have not yet put to work on an extensive scale in China the scientific methods in farming which will be necessary if they're going to solve the problem of agricultural production.
This is definitely one of the mistakes the Chinese communists up to today.
They, at the present time, have not gotten around to doing it. They claim they're going to do it, but if they keep on delaying too long, they, in essence, today have a tiger by the tail, to use a Chinese term. That means they've got a hold of a society which has too many people for the amount of resources they have available. The Chinese communists have somehow got to solve the problem of how do you feed and provide for those people, and at the same time, they've promised to industrialize the country.
They are making certain steps, however, not in the way of scientific farming exactly, but in large-scale farming, particularly in Manchuria, the development of new lands there along cooperative lines.
True, but I think that those techniques and those methods are applicable only to Manchuria. That is, if we're going to solve the problem of increased agricultural production in China, it has to be done along lines that have not yet been devised. And in Manchuria, it's my understanding that they have, as a matter of fact, tried to copy Russian methods up there.
You see, from their point of view, they would say, indoctrinate the people, get them to accept these new forms, and then you can carry out those methods in China proper as well as in Manchuria.
Well, I asked a number of communist officers who happened to be captured at Jinmen Island whether or not they had been taught new methods of agriculture. They all agreed that China's basic problem was agricultural, but they themselves had not been taught any improved techniques of agriculture that they could apply either when they went home to their farms or even in the army while they were producing for the needs of the army in specific areas.
China's basic problem is, I have no doubt, agriculture, but I have yet to be in any Asian country where there isn't a dream that somehow the country can be industrialized and its problems solved that way.
Yes. Well, the Chinese communists certainly recognize very clearly that they have to industrialize China. In fact, that was generally realized by all Chinese, practically all educated Chinese, for many years. The question is, how do you do that in a country like China? Their economy at present is based upon the countryside. In order to industrialize the cities, you have to draw away from that rural economy. They have come to power by the support of the peasants. How can they industrialize the cities and at the same time retain that peasant support and not put too heavy a burden on the peasants to carry out that industrialization?
One obvious answer to that, I should think, is outside assistance. Is it impossible that America should trade with communist China?
Such trade is going on. The question is, how long will it continue to go on? Will the United States itself accept such an arrangement? We already have an embargo on things precisely which the Chinese communists would like to have.
Well, I think there's another angle to that, too, and that is the Chinese communists are convinced that our institutions are no use to them. Rightly or wrongly, they feel that we have devolved out of a capitalist society and therefore they cannot use many of our industrial organization techniques, which actually might be the answer to some of their problems.
I think you're a little sweeping in that, Ravenholt. I don't entirely agree with you. I think they're more eclectic than you suppose.
I think that to a very large extent, if we should distinguish between the Chinese communists, that is, some of the Chinese and communists on top are very sophisticated individuals, men who have a great understanding of their own country and some understanding of the outside world. But it's my impression that some of the communists on lower levels are very doctrinaire.
That's right, yes, no doubt about it.
I would take it you both agree that the Chinese communists have not yet effectively found a way of dealing with the basic problem of taking care of the peasants that they must find if they are to remain as a government with broad peasant support. What about some of the achievements they have so far chalked up?
Well, on the purely economic side, they've restored communications with remarkable rapidity. The railroads are running again, and they're running better than they have for a good many years, to all report.
Also, I think they have established the administration in China in a form which has not been since the fall of the Manchu dynasty. That is, the nationalist government's authority in many of the outlying areas of China was limited by the willingness of the local warlords or governors to accept the instructions or the legislation passed in Chongqing or Nanking. The communists have eliminated those warlords, given a few of them jobs, but more or less paper jobs in their government, and now they have administrative control of the entire country with the exception of parts of Tibet.
In this report on communist China on the University of Chicago Roundtable, we're not discussing the question of whether the Chinese are good or bad in the new communist regime, but what they are doing in terms of meeting the problems that face them. If they have achieved these points that you have made, why? How have they done it when the nationalists apparently could not meet the same problems?
Well, it seems to me that they have first a clear-cut program, an idea of what they want to do, which the Kuomintang, I think, did not have. And it's directed around discipline, subservience of the individual to the cause, cooperative effort. They've made a tremendous stress upon certain moral qualities which are comparatively new in Chinese history and which have made a tremendous impression on many other people. They've tried to wipe out graft, and I think there's less graft there than there has been for many years in the past.
Also, I think the Chinese communists have generated a massive psychological pressure that's new to China. The individual is not forced by the police to conform. He is forced, I think it would be a sign of weakness on the part of the communists when they start using police powers extensively to deal with the population as such. They use them to deal with bandits and guerrillas and others. But the individual in the large cities, and to some extent the peasants in the countryside, are organized into social groups. And it's in order to get along in society, in order to be part of a society, the individual has to join, and he does join, and he becomes caught up in this thing and organized for the ends of the communists to a large extent determined.
And there is a mass enthusiasm generated in that way.
But among certain social groups.
Yes, labor groups, student groups, and the like.
Well, now what happens if a person who is Chinese and who's lived under non-communist regime all of his life doesn't like these communists? I can't imagine that suddenly the communists come to power and everybody immediately likes them. What happens to the man who doesn't like them?
Well, a lot of them have left China, as a matter of fact, those who didn't like them.
I had it put to me very well by a young Chinese. He had come out from Shandong province, and in Shandong, before he left, he had met one of his old schoolmates, who was by now an official of the communist government and had graduated from several of the communist training schools. He and his old schoolmate, who was now a communist, had a series of long discussions, the result of which was the communist friend told him, he said, either you've got to join us or you've got to get out. If you're going to stay around here, you'll have to join us. There's no other way you can survive in the future. That, I think, is essentially true as regards the young students, as regards the literate population. As regards the old people, they can more or less retire and sit by the wayside and watch things. But the young people are forced, if they want to go along, to join up in this thing because there's nothing else for them to do.
In other words, society is consciously being reorganized so that the old bases of power no longer exist, and so that in order to get on, get along with other people, and get food, and get work, Individual Chinese must go along with the communist regime. Is that
right? He has no choice at the present time unless he's willing to go out into the countryside and become a bandit or a guerrilla. And that's happened only in far west China and far south China on an extensive basis.
Well, now these revolutionary urges, which existed in China, as you say, have existed for a long time, also exist in other countries in Asia. That is the dynamic of Asia today. The communists have one solution. In the parts of Asia that I know anything about, I'm convinced that the communist solution is not the only solution, that there are other solutions as well.
Well, Talbot, I think that we give the Chinese communists too much credit if we assign them the role of having created this Chinese revolution. I'd say rather that the Chinese communists moved over and have taken over management of the revolution. They are now directing its course. They are now training the people who are going to shape the new government and the new society that they're creating. But it's part of an enormous social upheaval that is affecting not only the political and economic structure of the society, but that is affecting the structure of the family, that's tearing apart the old human relationships, that is knocking to pieces the old conception of faith. The communists are in control of it now, but they didn't create it initially.
No. That goes back long before the communists, but they have given it a conscious direction and a dynamic force, which it lacked before, I believe.
The force includes, does it not, a very strong army?
I think that the army at the present time serves certain functions inside of China, but it has to be considered in a different context. That is, the Chinese Communist Army today is either the largest, or next after the Russian, the second largest standing army in the world. The frontline Chinese Communist troops today number about 2,400,000. In addition to that, they have roughly 2,700,000 second-line or military district troops. To get an idea of the Chinese Communist military machine today, you'd have to take what we have been fighting in North Korea and multiply it by at least 20. It'll give you some picture of what we'd be up against if we come into war with the Chinese communists.
Well, what does this all add up to, these mistakes, these basic difficulties that the regime faces, its successes, and its power potential?
It adds up to the fact that the communists are there, and they're going to be there for a long time to come, and we have to recognize that fact and plan our course accordingly.
It adds up to the fact also, I believe, that in Asia, if we're going to be on the Asian continent, we can survive only by using our wits. That is, we can use military force in certain situations wherever we have the capability of doing so. But we also have to use all of the techniques of diplomacy, the techniques of propaganda, to an extent that we have not used them up until the present time.
And we have to understand their psychology to a much greater degree, I think, than we have in the past.
Well, I think the direct question to that is, to what extent are the Chinese communists controlled by Moscow?
Well, that's a matter which differs according to their internal domestic program and their foreign program. They developed in China for a long time before they came into complete power of the country. They worked out solutions according to the local situation. In planning those solutions, they were influenced comparatively little, very little, I would say, from by Moscow. But now they're in control of the entire country. They're in face-to-face with the question of foreign relations, which are new to them. And in that sphere of foreign relations, they pretty much follow the Russian line.
It's my impression that for a great number of the Chinese communists, Moscow, so to speak, is the holy city. And what comes out from there is taken at face value. At least that was true. It may be that it's now changing.
May I say on that also that there are large numbers of non-communist Chinese, of course, who are very doubtful about this alignment in foreign affairs with Moscow, who don't like it. That is a weak point, I would say, in the Chinese communist setup.
Also, Russians at the present time, it's my impression, are making very determined and, to some extent, realistic efforts to influence the state of affairs in China. That is, the Russians, wherever possible, are furthering the interests of particular Chinese communists who see the development of communism in China in essentially the same terms as the Russians see it.
Well, the thing that I still am concerned about is the problem of how much control in the interior of China, in an internal government, there is from Russia. Is this going to be a revolution in which Russians can continue to have major influence?
I think that Russia's influence will depend upon several factors. One, the success and the skill with which they play their cards and use their opportunities. Two, the extent to which China does or does not become associated with other countries aside from Russia. At the present time, the Indians, for example, are making an extensive effort to bring the Chinese communists into realization of the fact that they have some community of interest with the rest of Asia.
I think it would be a profound mistake in that connection to lump China together with the little countries of Eastern Europe. The situation is very different in China from those countries.
In other words, China is not a satellite.
I wouldn't consider it so. They cooperate with Russia because, on the whole, they want to cooperate.
Also, I think we have to remember and think of what China was under at the height of the previous dynasties, when countries such as Korea, Vietnam, parts of Burma, parts of Indonesia, were tribute-bearing states. The French got the province of Tonkin in northern Indochina only after defeating the Chinese in the War of 1884.
That's the thing that strikes me, that the whole balance of power in Asia is changed by the emergence of a strong China after many years when there has been a very weak China indeed. Today we have news that the French are withdrawing from the northernmost posts of Indochina and that Ho Chi Minh's group is taking over up there. The influence of the Chinese Revolution on the revolutions of these neighboring areas, I think, is very, very important. It is a measure of the problem now facing the United States, I think, that communist China has developed to the extent that it has. And I take it you gentlemen agree that communist China can only be dealt with today as a major power in Asia and perhaps a major power in the world.
Thank you, gentlemen. Taking part in today's University of Chicago Roundtable on Report on Communist China, fifth in a series on the problems of Asia, were Albert Ravenholt, Far Eastern correspondent, Chicago Daily News, Dirk Bader, Far Eastern expert, University of Pennsylvania, and Phillips Talbot, senior associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. The printed pamphlet of today's roundtable discussion of Report on Communist China contains the full text of the discussion and the supplementary articles, reading lists, and materials on Communist China. Be sure to write to the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, to secure your copy of today's pamphlet. Single copies are 10 cents in coin. A full year subscription to the Roundtable pamphlet costs only $3. Enclose $3 with your order and make your subscription begin with today's program on Report on Communist China. I'll repeat the address, the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois. Next week, the Roundtable continues its series on problems of Asia with a discussion of the Point 4 program in Asia. Be sure to hear this important discussion. May we invite you to join in the new Roundtable Home Study course on human rights. This course is open to all. You may enroll and begin at any time. Write the University of Chicago Roundtable, Chicago 37, Illinois, for the brochure describing the course and telling how you may register. Each month, a 24-volume set of the Encyclopedia Britannica is awarded to that student who most successfully completes the course that month. Today's program originated in Radio City, New York. The Roundtable is directed by George E. Probst and is a public service presentation by NBC. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.